These days, everyone who has a mobile device can take great photos and shoot videos, showing up all the time on Flickr, Instagram, Facebook, and a host of other social media sites. You point your phone and shoot a picture. Sometimes it's a hit, and many times it's a miss. So what separates the amateurs from the pros? For over 125 years, Dodd Camera has assisted photographers, both professional and amateur, with state-of-the-art cameras, lenses, lighting and darkroom equipment, and class instruction. You can learn about new equipment from their blog or attend one of the many in-store events. The folks at Dodd Camera are helpful, professional, and experienced. They'll take the time to answer your questions and give you advice you can use. You may go to doddcamera.com to find out more. And finally, we wish to thank Dodd Camera for sponsoring the Outspoken Cyclist podcast.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for March 24th, 2018. It's taken a lot of self-control to not turn into a raging maniac when it comes to safety and bicyclists, and this week I almost didn't keep it together. Two stories in particular have raised my hackles and point to the urgent need for some real change in the way drivers see cyclists and pedestrians, as well as the way law enforcement and legislation deals with those who harm us. The first story is about Judge Judith K. Dulcich in Bakersfield, California, who decided in a preliminary hearing to allow defendant John Guimara III, a member of a prominent farming family, to plead no contest to a misdemeanor instead of the DUI felony charge the district attorney was going to enter for hitting a cyclist, killing her, and leaving the scene of the accident. While we see a lot of cases slip through the cracks or adjudicated in a less than satisfying manner, this just smacks of either some sort of special interest or just bad judgment. If you'd like to read the story, you can find it at bakersfield.com under News for March 21st. Of course, the second story is the case of the Uber autonomous vehicle in Tempe, Arizona, that somehow was unable to recognize a pedestrian walking a bicycle across the street and hit and killed her. The fact that there was actually a driver in the car who was clearly distracted, the inside car cam shows him not paying attention to where the car was going and only saw what was happening in the last second, makes it even more horrific. Regardless of the reasons a judge would make this choice or a car would be involved in the death of a pedestrian or a cyclist, everyone is aware that there is no contest between a car and a cyclist, period. There is almost never a reason to kill a pedestrian or cyclist and walk away with a slap on the wrist. It's just plain wrong, and it should be illegal. We will watch the Uber case carefully, and perhaps this could be a tipping point for the changes so desperately needed in these issues. So let's move on with the show. It's unusual for me to have a guest in the studio, and this week I was so pleased that Richard Schwinn, yep, that Waterford guy, swung by while on a Midwest road trip to visit dealers. It is always fun to chat with Richard, and this conversation has some interesting tidbits about everything from electronifying, his term, not mine, to the 25th anniversary of the Waterford line. We laugh a little bit, too. After a break, it's a conversation with bike shop owner Joe Nocella. Joe is an architect by training. He was a teacher at Pratt. He runs a lacrosse league for inner city kids, and he's the owner of 718 Cycles in Brooklyn, New York. With a great New York attitude, he relates his philosophy about his shop and what it does that keeps his customers engaged and excited about cycling. Oh, and racing is nowhere to be seen. So may I reintroduce you to my friend and colleague, Richard Schwinn.
Hello, Richard. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me in the studio. It's nice to see you again.
Again, in fact, I am delighted to be here on the mountain with you, one of the most notorious people in the bike world.
I don't know if that's a compliment or not. Notorious?
No, I'm going to go with that, yeah.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about your road trip. What are you doing on the road and how did you come to see us? I'm so excited. This is really cool.
Well, we decided a couple of years ago to shift our emphasis from going to trade shows to doing road shows. And of course, we can't be on the road all the time because there's not a lot of us at Waterford. So I've made a point of trying to get around to different parts of the country. And this time, we are traveling through the Midwest, starting Indianapolis, Cincinnati, Columbus, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, City of Light, City of Magic, Detroit, and coming back to Chicago. So,
I see you're making a little circle. Cool. Well, what have you seen? Are you seeing good things?
Well, we're seeing our dealers, and our company emphasizes its sales through bike shops. And we think bike shops are a very important part of the selling process for bikes at our level because, you know, they provide an interface that we can't be there for all the time. And there's just too much of the process of buying a good quality bike requires the expertise of a dealer, the service of putting the bike together, the service of following up, bike fitting, a whole slew of things like that. So we've got a great network of dealers, and it's great to be in touch with them and find out what's going on in their world.
Yeah, so I know that you visited Brian earlier today.
Indeed.
And got to see a really pretty Waterford being put together.
Indeed.
That was a complicated build.
Yes.
Well, and is that typical that customers like the man who purchased this Waterford, which will be, you know, an adventure bike in some way? It's got racks and it's got fenders and it's got internal lighting and all that stuff. Are you seeing that as typical?
Well, that's been typical for a long time. Now, the use of fenders and racks is a small part of our business, but most of the bikes that we build today are what I would call broad spectrum bikes. We're used to thinking of high-end bikes as being road racing bikes. Particularly starting in the 80s, the thought was if you were going to have a nice bike, you were going to strip off everything that wasn't going to help you go faster in a race.
Right.
And when we started Waterford, we were really good at building that kind of bike, but we also felt that people wanted to use bikes for a lot of other things. They wanted to ride for fun. They wanted to carry things. And if you take a look at Waterford's, we started off with road racing bikes and off-road racing bikes. But very soon afterwards, and you saw it, we started adding bikes with things like fender eyelets and rack mounts and all sorts of other accoutrements that would allow you to enjoy bikes in a lot of different ways. In 1998, that's 20 years ago.
Yes, I am well aware.
20 years ago, we introduced the Gunner brand of bikes, named after our good old dog Gunner. May he rest in peace.
Yeah.
And if you look at those bikes, every single one of them was designed to be more flexible. We had a very raceable road race bike, but we did throw eyelets, which weigh, I'm going to tell you, 12 grams.
Oh my gosh, Richard.
A 12-gram investment in making your bike useful not only at the races, but some other time. The Gunner Crosshairs was a cross bike that was really a bike that was designed to do a whole lot of things, an early commuter bike. And one of the things that's happened over the last 30 years is the infrastructure for commuting and riding has improved so much throughout this country. And every city has a major program to improve safety for cyclists, great places to ride, trails. In Cleveland, you started out, what was the name of the big trail?
The Metro Parks. Oh, the Towpath?
Well, you have the Towpath Trail and the Metro Parks Trail.
We have a bike and hike. We have a lot.
More importantly, you now have an entire network of roads and ways to get to those paths. In those days, if you wanted to do that ride, You got up in the morning, you put your bike on your car, you drove your car to a parking lot, and then you took your bike off and you went for a ride, and then it reversed the process and at the end of the day. Today, that same person starts from home. They've got a bike lane. They've got safe places to get to the trails that they want to ride to. And now all of a sudden, it's really starting to change people's habits. That's actually changed a lot of the bikes that are being sold today. We've been at this for some time. It's becoming more and more mainstream.
First, let me remind our listeners, I am sitting across from Richard Schwinn. He is the owner of Waterford Precision Cycles up in Waterford, Wisconsin. If we look at today's bikes, there are some standards that are not really standard. There are things that are changing: through axles, new bottom brackets, disc brakes. How are you keeping up with all this technological, you know, re-wrangling of the actual bike frame?
Well, the bike business has been in more flux than it has been in the last quarter century. The reason is that we are seeing the introduction of so many new standards. If you go back 30 years for any kind of good bike, it generally had one rear dropout spacing.
Right.
They were all going to have derailleurs. It had one bottom bracket dimension. You had one steer tube size. The big radical thing that happened in 1988 was introducing oversized tubes, which is we added an eighth of an inch to the top tube and the down tube.
Right.
And then the 135 spacing, the introduction of mountain bikes, right. New gearing, things like that. And it caused havoc in the industry because people didn't know where the technology was going to go. It kind of stabilized. Mountain bikes went off in one direction. Road bikes went off in another direction. And then you start really probably about 7 or 8 years ago, you start seeing influx of new standards. The press fit bottom brackets, for example, were the first thing out of the box. We started seeing people with fat bikes experimenting with different dropout spacings. And a lot of this has to do with the introduction of disc brakes. And disc brakes have a number of merits. They're better for wet braking. They put less wear and tear on bicycle rims. So there's a lot of reasons to have them. But the standards for adding these to a bike design have not been stable. Today, there are, for example, 3 or 4 different mounting systems for brakes. You know, we grew up with one mounting system. It either fit the brake or it didn't fit the brake, and that's it. We have 3 different mounting systems for derailleurs. We have 3 or 4 different bottom bracket dimensions. We have press fit bottom brackets. We've got the 68 millimeter wide. We've got a 73. There's apparently, I think you can go up to 100 millimeter wide. And then we have the whole issue of three-axle design, which is a major departure from the quick releases that dominated the high end of the industry for, probably 30 years.
Oh, at least.
And so all of these things have put the market in flux. For us, the difficult part is trying to find those innovations that are going to stick. Because people who buy Waterfords and people who buy Gunners are not buying them to use for 1 year. They are buying them as a longer-term investment.
So is your concern that if you build something with this dropout, that something's going to change so that that dropout will no longer be appropriate if brakes change?
Exactly. That is a fear. So
sure.
We've tried to select technologies that look like they have a long lifetime. Now, the older technologies, things like caliper brakes, they're not going away.
No.
Cantilever brakes are not going away. They function today better than they ever have through the engineering of the big component suppliers. When we get into disc brakes, the question is what disc brakes technologies are actually going to survive. And
do you have an opinion on that?
Of course, I have an opinion on everything.
Well, that's true. What a stupid question, Diane.
Thank you.
And I don't usually ask stupid questions, but in this case, yeah,
go ahead. In this case, I'm excited about the flat mount disc brake technology. What's nice about it, it does 2 things that are really important. One is it gets the caliper away from people's heels. We've had disc brakes on our bikes for general purpose bikes for many years. And you know, one of the problems is that you can strike your heel on the brake. It's an annoyance. It's not a big deal. Nobody gets hurt doing it, but we don't like annoyances. We're not in the annoyance business. The flat mount brakes are placed inboard so that you can't strike your heel on it unless you're going to strike the chainstay itself. And that's a different problem.
Right.
The second advantage of it, and it's other technologies can also do it, but this does it quite nicely, is it puts the caliper on the chain stay, not the seat stay. And on a bike, the seat stay is really kind of it's the tube that should be the weakest and the flimsiest tube out there because it's just kind of tying the rest of the frame together. If a bike is going to function properly, the chain stays have to be strong enough. That's probably the most important tube connection on a bike frame, that in the down tube. Otherwise, you can't connect the rest of the parts.
So, there's a lot of torque on that bottom bracket.
Exactly.
Right.
And the earlier disc brake designs had the disc brakes on the seat stay, so now we had to have a super strong seat stay plus a strong chain stay. So now by putting the flat mount brakes on the chain stay themselves, we get to put the strength in one area, and we get to make the rest of the bike a little more comfy.
I want to talk about materials, one of my favorite topics.
Indeed.
So you did spend some time with Varywall, and we had an interview with the Varywall people not too long ago. True Temper is gone, and I know you used a lot of True Temper product. Tell me about, in this world of carbon fiber, how you stand out as a steel manufacturer and how that works.
Well, I mean, steel has a whole range of great benefits, particularly as you get into custom bikes. It is a much more flexible material. It is a more predictable material. We can design things on a custom basis that are much harder to design in carbon fiber. You can design in carbon fiber if you want to build 1,000 of them or 2,000. So it lends itself well to mass production, but it doesn't lend itself to individualized production. And at our level, our customers are discerning enough that they have individual preferences. If you want to buy the fanciest Trek, you know, whatever is their fancy model, like the Madone or something like that.
Madone.
Well, no, they've got a new generation.
Oh, do
girl.
They?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm behind the times.
Yeah, you are
usual.
Behind the times.
Oh, okay.
You're going to spend a lot of money on it, and you go, you know, I'd really like to have a pump peg on this. And they go, well, it's not going to happen. I just want a pump peg. I want to put a frame pump on there. Sorry. I want an extra set of water bottle bosses. Nope. The flexibility of steel is very important. That plays with nice creature features like the bosses that you want to put on it. It also plays out with bike fit, and our customers tend to be more discerning about their bike fit. So there are ways of adapting a bike fit. There are a lot of people who go, well, you never need to have a custom bike, but it's nice to have it when you can get it. The steel gives us the opportunity to actually bring forth more real innovation. And down the road, when it passes the mass market test, then you're going to see it in the carbon fiber frame. And you'll see that with the bikes that we're doing today.
Let me remind our listeners one more time. We're speaking with Richard Schwinn. He is the owner of Waterford Precision Cycles, and he has graced our studio with his presence today because I haven't seen him. I don't even remember the last time I saw you. It's been a long time.
We've done podcasts. We've done them.
But we've done them via the telephone.
By the telephone or the internet
in
or
the
whatever.
Internet. Right, right.
I think we caught up at a trade show once.
Yeah. Let's talk about these tariffs. What's going to happen? Do you see any problems for you? Well, probably not for you, but is Varywall thinking there's going to be a problem?
We were talking about that today. These tariffs are a disaster for American business. They're a disaster because the tariffs apply to the raw material. They don't apply to things that are bought with that raw material. So, for example, if we have a competitor who brings in a steel bicycle frame or a carbon bicycle frame or whatever, aluminum bicycle frame, their prices aren't going to change. In our case, I don't believe that our prices are going to change on tubing because of the nature of the supply of that particular tubing. But if that company is dealing with more generic tubing, then what's happening is the aluminum suppliers are raising their prices because they no longer have as much foreign competition. So the cost of our American-made, our American-manufactured products are going to go up and make them less competitive, which is going to reduce demand for the raw material that got the protection. So it is a self-defeating strategy. It is there to do nothing more than to follow through with a dumb campaign promise. And that's all I can say.
You don't need to say more. I don't think you'll get a lot of disagreement here. We're going to take a real short break. And when we come back, we're going to ask Richard some things about how he sees the bike industry right now and where he thinks it's going. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM. WJCU University Heights.
We're back, and if you're just joining us, I have in studio with me Richard Schwinn, owner of Waterford Precision Cycles from Wisconsin, only he's in Cleveland today. And before the break, we were talking about the tariffs and how the whole situation of steel tariffs is just going to be one big, as they say, cluster. What are you seeing in our bike industry that actually gives you some hope?
One of the things that I'm seeing is the storm of new standards seems to be abating. The big magic of the bike design, of bike design, is the fact that there are so many standard parts. We were talking earlier today that you could take the parts off a bike from 30 years ago, and at least half of them would still fit on a bike today.
Right.
A derailleur, for example, many of the brakes, things like that. Today, if you really want to have an up-to-date design, there's so many standards that are moving around. Headset dimensions. I mean, we had a list earlier. I can go through it again, but we need not bore your listeners.
Well, the headset thing is, I think, interesting. It went from 1 inch to 1 1/8, and then Santana used 1 1/4 for a while, and now I don't know what the hell, 30 millimeter this, that. It's crazy.
Yeah, and we're using a 44 millimeter head tube because of the newer fork designs. So, yeah, those are things that are changing, and I think we're seeing some signs that it's going to settle down a little bit.
That's good.
And that's going to make it easier for people to buy bikes that they want to last a long time. It's going to be less risky for them.
Look back in history a moment, and how many, or let's just use Waterford, it's the 25th anniversary.
Yeah.
That's amazing, Richard. I don't know how that happened.
25th anniversary.
I don't know how that happened. How many of those bikes do you think are still on the road that you built 25 years ago?
I'd be pulling a number out of my butt.
Okay.
I would say
20%, 25%.
Oh, no. I mean, it's 60 to 75%.
Yeah, see, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So what are you seeing in our industry that you're dismayed about, that you just can't believe that's what's happening? Anything?
Well, again, the whole issue of standards is it. I'm not dismayed by it because the attack on standards is part of the innovation process. At some point, it's important to attack the standards because new technology is going to change the things that drove the standards in the first place. So it's always more chaotic during that period. There is more experimentation. And then at some point, we have to come to a conclusion of a standard that people can rely on. Those people who want to buy, who are really investing in their bikes for a longer term.
Who's driving these changes? What's driving these changes?
Well, we talked to some of the component suppliers, and they are driven by their, what we call OE customers, original equipment customers.
Right.
So Trek and Specialized, and in fact, every company wants to create a difference for their bike. That's just good marketing. Waterford certainly does that. One of the ways to do that is to introduce innovation. Think of the things that sell. We have Sex, we have Free, and we have New.
Okay.
No one in business wants Free, and Sex is hard to do, so we're up to New.
We're left with New.
We're left
by
with
default.
New. And so let's introduce something new, and that allows us to compete, because if that doesn't happen, then we actually have to become better. And that's a lot harder than just new.
Heaven forbid we should be better.
Better.
Right.
And Waterford wants to be better. So we have to be careful about the new that we adopt to make sure that it actually is better for a longer term. So that's our model. Not everybody has that model. And in fact, one of the ways you break into the industry is to have that breakthrough innovation that everybody's got to have. Every company around, whether it's a component supplier or a manufacturer, even a frame builder, would love to have that unique selling proposition. It's a classic marketing term. And that creates the innovation cycle. At this point, there has to be a reason. And at some point, we have to discern the innovations that actually make sense versus the ones that don't.
Right.
We try to do that discernment as part of our selection of technologies that we're going to work with. And sometimes it just takes a little time for two reasonable technologies. One of them wins and you pick one.
Yeah, that's true. So electronics, I would not say I'm seeing the majority of bikes going out with the electronic shifters.
No.
How about you? No?
Oh, no. And part of it is electronic shifting is good, and SRAM and Shimano both have very good systems, but they really only solve part of the problem. They do something that actually works pretty well, and they only do it a little bit better. They're not going to fundamentally change it. I would like to see a more comprehensive and coordinated electronification of bikes. Today, people are using their bikes in a far wider context than they used to. In the old days, I have a road race bike, I'm a road racer. I go on disease rides, I'm a disease ride rider. I ride for fitness, and I'm a triathlete, I'm whatever I am. And today, we're finding people wanting to use their bikes for just transportation. They want to make bikes a part of their transportation lives the way they make their cars part of their transportation lives. To do that, bikes are going to have to have more features that are appropriate to that, not the stripped down bikes that we tend to try to sell because of the old methodology of selling bikes. We have to rethink that. There's certainly a group for which that is always going to make sense, but the bigger group that's out there are people who go, it's a bike that I want to ride every day in a lot of different ways. So we need to be thinking about lighting. We need to be thinking about carrying capacity. We need to be thinking about things like fenders, parkability, security, how to avoid flats. Imagine if you had to pump up your car tires 3 days a week.
Yeah, that would piss you off.
Right.
Right. That's a really good point.
I'm used to doing it. Every time I go out on a bike, the first thing I do is I check my air pressure.
Right.
You know, wouldn't it be great that I go, I don't even have to think about it?
That would be great. That would be awesome.
Yeah. I think there are some innovations that are heading us there. I'm excited about the tubeless tires.
Tubeless. Brian likes them a lot.
That's going to be huge. The whole security issue. Bikes still get stolen. You know, we sell a frame that might weigh, you know, 3 to 5 pounds. And you got to have a 3 to 5 pound lock on it. Okay?
It's true. And people complain about that. They don't want to carry a 5 pound lock to lock up their 19 pound bike.
Worse than that, think about the time. I want to take a trip to the store. Oh, I got to figure out where I'm going to lock my bike.
What would be an alternative?
Well, actually, electronics give us a.
Yes.
Now, imagine.
Interesting.
You know,
yes.
Now, I happen to have electronic shifting on one of my bikes, and my batteries ran dead.
What is wrong with you? You knew that was happening.
It was the first ride out, and I'm like, oh, these batteries have been sitting around for 4 months. I'm just going to get on my bike and ride. Wait a minute here. All I got is a small gear.
That is correct, and there is no changing it.
There's no changing it. So I'm going, okay, well, that's interesting. What would happen if I could control your access to your shifting? So if you're a Steve, you're going to get a low gear. You can't go anywhere.
Right.
Now, what would happen if you had anti-lock brakes that you could lock electronically?
Oh, that would be cool.
So now you got to lift a bike up. Now, what happens if you've got enough electric power to be able to transmit the location of a bike that happens to be in an authorized situation?
I'm not quite getting that.
Well, you left it over on the corner there. It's moved somewhere from the corner while you were getting some coffee.
Right.
Okay.
How did it get moved? Right.
How did it get moved?
Right. Sticky fingers.
And what would happen if you had literally a bike alarm that started announcing, this is an unauthorized move. Please put me down.
Right, right.
And
step away from the bike.
Step away from the bike. And I think that this move toward adding these types of features will solve some really important considerations that everyone has to live with when they buy their own bike.
Well, there's one category before we sign off, because we're running out of time, that we have not talked about, and it is not necessarily in your wheelhouse, but somehow I think you've been thinking about it, e-bikes. What about pedal assist?
Oh, I think pedal assist is going to be part of our world because we're broadening out our transportation alternatives from the car. We just have to do it. Cities don't have room for cars. The cities have paid a price for not having enough room for people because they need to make room for cars. Now, there are going to be several gradations of electric bikes. Some of them are electric bikes that are principally electric bikes. They weigh 50 pounds. If you run out of battery, you don't want to ride the bike.
Right.
The second group are people who want to ride a bike, but due to age or other considerations, they may have certain riding limitations. For example, we have a lot of people who are buying bikes in their 70s and even 80s, and they're buying Waterfords because they want to have a nice bike. Now what's happening is they hit that point where a hill that has been a great challenge all their life is just beyond their capabilities. So what are they supposed to do? Stop riding?
No.
One of the things that we see as a real possibility for them is to have a very lightweight electric supplement for them. But it has to be light enough. It's got to be, you know, less than 5 pounds, and it gets you up the hill. It's not 40 pounds so that you can ride a bike 20 miles.
So it's an add-on.
It's an add-on.
Is that something you're going to be able to add on to a Waterford?
There's one supplier who's doing that, and we're very interested in that technology. We think that that may be could be a very positive program.
Yeah, I like that idea. Wow. Well, we could go on and on and on. What? Talk to me.
I was going to say you should probably take just a moment and pause, and somewhere you need to ask the question, got any interesting projects at Waterford?
Oh, that is my last question. It's actually on the paper. Okay. Excuse me, Richard. Do you have any interesting projects at Waterford? As if she didn't know the answer.
Of course we do.
Of course we do.
Well, actually, we're introducing a couple of new models on the Gunner side.
Before you say that, tell the audience, not everybody knows the difference between a Waterford and a Gunner, and they both come out of the same factory. So just real briefly, break it down.
Okay. We have the Gunner is a line that's got several pre-designed models in pre-designed sizes, and we have pre-designed stylings. Compared to a Trek, it's a very customized bike. But compared to a Waterford, they're stock geometries. But we've thought through some of these designs so that people have a starting point for what they want to ride. Okay. With a Waterford, everything we design from scratch. We start with the four Fs. We start with function, then we go to fit, then we go to the road feel or feel and finish. So we literally design a U-bike, and that's really the fundamental difference.
Okay.
So in the Gunner side, we've got two projects that we're working on right now. One is what people are calling a gravel bike, and it's actually another name for bikes that we've actually been doing for years. When we introduced the Gunner Crosshairs, that was a gravel bike. In fact, today, it's still a very competitive gravel bike. But what we're doing now is we're incorporating the technologies that we think are going to stand the test of time, the flat mount brakes. And we've got a new version of a model called the HyperX that is designed to take advantage of that. Second thing we're doing in the Gunner side is we're introducing an adventure bike that will have non-suspension corrected geometry. And if you take a look at a mountain bike today and you take a look at forks have just gotten taller and taller and taller.
Yes.
And so for one thing, these bikes don't barely fit half the population. And that's of men. Let's not even get into the ladies. In fact, I would say that only about 40% of women can fit a mountain bike today.
Wow. And I didn't even think about that.
It's driven by the fork size as much as anything else. So we said, okay, the people who are riding for adventure, the people who are going off into the forest who want to do bike camping and things like that, they're not concerned about having 3 inches, 4 inches, 5 inches of travel. They're riding on a 2.5-inch tire. They already have an inch and a half of travel, and that's going to allow them to ride on a whole lot more terrain than trying to ride something that you would never want to ride if you have a load. If you're carrying panniers, you don't need 3 inches of travel.
No.
So we're designing a bike to actually make that part work, and there's a really growing level of excitement over. We think that's going to be a cool little market.
I think bicycle touring, especially even off-road and path touring, is just exploding.
Yes, exactly. Now, the other area that we're looking at, this is a celebration year. It's 25 years.
I know. You keep telling me that.
I keep telling you that. So we are doing a 25th anniversary Waterford.
Well, I have seen part of it. I've seen the head section of it, and it is mind.
Well, you know, we've done a number of tribute bikes. We have good friends over at Schwinn, and so we actually build a we've been building Paramount, like a 75th anniversary bike. That was a really cool bike. We're very honored to build it. What we want to do with the 25th anniversary Waterford is we want to celebrate the next 25 years, not the last one. So we're actually going to build a bike that, as you look at it, you're going to go, 25 years from now, how am I going to look at this bike?
The Jetsons.
Right? Yes. I can never whistle on command, but yes, that's the idea. So it's a really exciting project. What you saw were some test lugs, because we're actually going to use modern tube dimensions. We're going to be able to fit a tapered steer fork on it. It will actually be of a size that allows us to put that electric motor in it.
Very cool.
So not everybody's going to be interested in the electric motor. We've got a lighter tube set for that, but we think it's going to be the kind of bike that not only people are going to say it's a great celebration of where we've been, but it's also a great celebration of where we're going.
That's a great place to sort of wrap this up. I want to remind listeners, we've been talking with Richard Schwinn. He is the owner of Waterford Precision Cycles in Waterford, Wisconsin. You can go to waterfordbikes.com and see all the stuff we've been talking about, although I don't think the 25th anniversary future bike is up there yet.
Nope, not yet.
Not yet. How about some of the new gunners? Have you already announced the HyperX?
The HyperX, it's the HyperX flat mount version. We've had a HyperX out there,
okay.
but we've had different technologies, but that's out there. We have a bike called the Rock Tour, so this will be the Rock Tour Tour, and that you'll probably see that in the next month.
Well, this has been delightful. As always, Richard and I are going to go eat something because he's been on the road all day. And thank you so much for coming into the studio and taking like a whole lot of time to talk with me. I appreciate it.
Well, it is always a pleasure. And thank you very much. I really enjoy coming to the mountain.
All right, Richard. Have a great rest of your trip. Enjoy and get home safe.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Richard Schwinn was right here in the studio at WJCU, and as always, I love talking with him. Just as an FYI, we had a great dinner at Aladdin's after our conversation. It's a wonderful local Mediterranean restaurant here in Northeast Ohio. So let's take a short break, and when we come back, it's off to Brooklyn, New York for a conversation with shop owner Joe Nocella. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
Are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'd like to preface my conversation with Joe Nocella of 718 Cycles with a note. Joe was running solo the morning that we spoke, and so there were a couple of choppy places in our conversation when he had to go run, answer a phone, or talk to a client. I don't think it took anything away from our conversation, though.
Hello, Joe. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on our show today.
Great. Thanks for having us.
It is my pleasure, because when Outside Magazine posts an article and says something like Brooklyn's famed 718 cyclery, I take notice. Tell us a bit about Joe and how you started your bike shop.
I was a messenger in New York City in the late 80s while I was going to school from the area. Went away to school, came back in the early 90s. I was an architect in New York City. Really didn't have much connection with bikes and bike culture as I was starting a young family and working professionally. About 10 years ago, I had a bike stolen out of my front yard. It's Brooklyn, and that happens. And I had some friends convince me to build a bike, you know, as opposed to going and getting another bike, just to, you know, build one up and, you know, go through the process. And man, I just loved the parts. I loved looking for stuff. I loved hunting for things. I loved looking at old catalogs. And it became one of those things where bikes began to represent all the left brain and right brain things that architecture did for me. You know, in architecture, most architects have some kind of left brain, right brain scenario in terms of, oh, I like design and art, and then I like, you know, physics and math, and it's a great, and I was always that way and had a great career with it. But I think that subconsciously what drew me back into the world of bikes was that it really achieved all those things in a much shorter time frame.
You mean in building a building? Yeah, right.
Right. I was working on, like, this airport's going to be done in 12 years. I'm like, 12 years? Like, I'm going to be like three firms away from here by the time this thing is done. And with bikes, you're, you know, it's almost, I always describe it as like, you know, being a musician and hearing your song on the radio. You know, with bikes, there's an instant person's out there. You're affecting their life. You're affecting the city's traffic and pollution and all those things. And it's a lot more immediate. And, you know, there is a lot of left brain, right brain stuff in the bike world with the design, and then also the technology and the tools and all those things. So I think that, you know, it was a subconscious kind of pull in this world. So I tried doing it both for a while and then eventually just jumped over full time.
So how long ago did you open the bike shop? Give me some time frame here.
Sure. Yeah. So 10 years ago, I started building bikes in my backyard. 10 years ago is when I started officially 718 Cyclery. And the first 2 years were in my backyard on the weekends. I built a shed, and people would come from, gosh, I know it sounds like a cliche, but miles around, because they wanted to build bikes with me. You know, they wanted to have a project built, and man, I didn't know what I was doing. So I kind of stayed 5 minutes ahead of my customers and just provided a service that,
We were talking about you building bikes sort of in your backyard and your shed and people coming to do that. So yeah. I had a question, and that is, you are not building frames. You're taking an existing frame.
Right.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that you're not a frame builder per se.
Right. We're not fabricating.
So let me ask a different question. And I think it's really cool that that's not all you do. You also sell already bikes. Like, I looked at your site and you have a lot of manufacturers you represent. But you're not only an architect and a bike builder, you also started a nonprofit that teaches lacrosse to city kids. You teach at Pratt. And if people don't know about Pratt, it's the Pratt, it used to be called the Pratt Art Institute. I don't know if it's still called that. And then there's something about Eddie Van Halen that keeps popping up. So, Tell us a little bit about the lacrosse with the city kids and then the teaching, and then we'll talk about music because it also ties into a lot of stuff.
Yeah, cool. So I grew up playing lacrosse. I played through high school. I played, had a scholarship, played through college. You know, it's a sport that doesn't resonate well with urban kids. A lot of times I think there's some stigmatisms about the sport, and the sport certainly sends out a kind of a very boarding school, white, suburban kind of vibe. So when I got back to when I started working in New York City, I started volunteering with a local organization. My son was playing, and I wanted to kind of branch out and start my own organization, and I did that about 6 years ago. And it's just about removing the barriers of entry. You know, it's cost and logistics and perception. So
that's very cool.
Just remove the barriers, and you know, everyone's a volunteer. You know, hundreds and hundreds of kids, and every spring and every fall, that's what, you know, every Sunday, that's what I do. It's a lot of time, but it's a big part of my life, and the shop is kind of built around me not being here. You know, I don't have to be here every day. You know, I shouldn't have to be here every day.
That is so true. Having been chained to a shop. Go ahead.
Yeah, I can leave for a week at a time, and the people that are here have been with me for a long time, and they really know, you know, what this operation's all about and what kind of decisions need to be made. And yeah, you know, more often than not, you know, left to their own devices, folks seem to make the right decisions. So yeah, it's all good. So, and then,
cool.
So Pratt, I just resigned. So
okay, then. There.
It was just too much. I had to give up something.
Yeah.
I taught there for years and years in the interior design school. Although I'm not an interior designer, I knew the chair of the department very well and designed a class around some of the professional expertise that I had developed over the years. And that was fantastic. But that again was taking up a lot of time. And then, you know, the shop kind of, you know, takes up, you know, as much time as it have possible. So, yeah, it was really kind of like trying to, you know, and at the time I was also working my day job as an architect. So I had these four things going on. I had bike shop, I had frat, I had lacrosse, and I had day job. So my wife and I were like, we have to start getting rid of some of these. So, you know, we chose to get rid of the high paying air conditioned architecture job.
Yeah, of course. Why not? Right?
Right. Yeah, why not? Yeah. So, because, and the big thing was, like, you know, in shedding those things, the big thing was, and, you know, getting rid of Pratt also, you know, it left me with the two things that I kind of created, right? This lacrosse program and the bike shop. And I think that that deep down, I kind of wanted to see what would happen. I kind of wanted to, you know, take this thing and see where it's going to go. And I don't know where it's going to go. And that comes, that's the excitement of it. You know, with my day job, I knew 10 years from now, I'm going to be sitting over there with that guy sitting, and that's what I'll be doing. You know, it's like you could see yourself in here. It's like, I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, you know, which is kind of fun. Nerve-wracking, but fun, yeah.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Joe Nocella. He is the owner of 718 Cyclery.
718 by locals.
Okay, let me rephrase that. He is the owner of 718 Cyclery. We are going to figure out what that means in a moment. So yep. Before we do that, what the hell is going on with Eddie Van Halen?
Well, you know, I'm a big Van Halen fan. I think that when I grew up, it certainly was a big part of you know, the high school culture and the middle school culture, their music. And, you know, their sixth album was 1984, and that came out in 1984. I was 14, you know, and that was just like a seminal time for me. And then after that, they changed lead singers and blah, blah, blah. So for me, you know, and for most people here, you know, the band kind of ended in 1984. You know, what happened beyond then is just not recognizable to us. So, and a lot of music fans that work in the shop, a lot of people in the music industry that work in the shop. So there's always a lot of, you know, any bike shop, there's always a lot of music conversations. You're with each other all day. You're playing music. So we decided to go out and try to find autographed versions of all six of the first six albums. And we found five of them. We have them on our wall. Yeah. So we're just, you know, just a fan, you know, just a big fan of not Eddie so much, but, you know, David Lee Roth and the whole Van Halen thing, you know, and,
so wait.
You know, kind of.
You have five of the six, so is this like out there now in the universe that you're looking for that sixth signed album?
Yeah, and the challenge is like when either David Lee Roth or Eddie Van Halen signs an album, it's like $400 like on eBay or whatever. But if like, you know, you get Michael Anthony, who's the bass player, or the drummer, Alex, if they sign it, it's worth a lot less and easier to find. So it's about $30 to $35. So
oh.
You have you know, I'll take a look real quick. I believe it's the first album actually we're looking for. It's not as if I can't find it.
Right.
So it'll complete our collection on the wall. If you look at all of our staff bios, you'll see, you know, written around Van Halen lore.
Well, that's why I asked, because as I went through your website, I'm like, okay, this is just coming up way too often not to have some specific meaning. So one of the categories of bikes that is glaringly missing, which actually made me kind of happy when I went through your website, is racing bikes. So you go adventure bikes and you have recumbents and you have fat bikes and you have mountain bikes, no racing bikes. And I am sure that is by design. So who is your customer?
So we've really become what I consider like an adventure cycling shop. And it grew organically over the years as, you know, as I noticed that my staff was, they were going on camping trips on their days off. And there was so much experience with camping and touring and bikepacking that was just embedded in the staff. And it's like, you know, why are we trying to sell $500 hybrids? Like, does anyone here want to sell a $500 hybrid? And no one wanted to. So like, let's just be what we should want to be. Let's just, we don't have a sales staff. So that means, well, the mechanics, these are all the bikes that they all ride anyway. Let's just sell the things that we really enjoy, sell the things that we can talk about for hours, you know, sell the things that we don't have to act like a salesman on. And, you know, the racing side of things, you know, I think that our customer also is, because it's an urban customer and again, an urban, you know, urban outdoorsy kind of person, you know, most people that live here don't have the space in the budget for like the six bikes that they want to put in their garage. Like, they don't have a garage. It's a sixth floor apartment. So then you start getting into the idea of like one bike that can do a lot of things. You know, hey, I want to go on camping trips and I need to commute on this thing and I want to do some fitness riding in the park. So those things really tend to start leaning towards, you know, what I consider like capable bikes, but adventure bikes and gravel bikes, those are bikes that can really do a lot of different things. They have a lot of tire clearance, you can put racks and fenders on them. So that's kind of, you know, more and more that's a customer. We don't sell any of the big three or the big four, I guess. No Trek, no Specialized, no Giant, no Cannondale. They've all come at us in varying degrees and said no consistently because I want to run my business my way. Those companies make fantastic bikes, but, you know, the business arrangements, you know, can be a little
onerous.
But it's just a business arrangement that I'm not interested in.
Right. Right. No, I get it.
And also, we don't really have a racing streak. We put on a race. We put on three or four races a year, but they're kind of hilarious races where it's like a relay around the, you know, relay race with fat bikes. We did a fat bike race last year. We did a race in the snow where you had to, you know, it's like a biathlon where you have to stop and use a Nerf gun to shoot and knock over targets before you can get on your bike and go again, like the biathlon in the Winter Olympics, like we do those kinds of races. So that's where our spirit is. It's not about podiums and stuff like that. So
what do you think has changed the most looking over the last, let's say, 5 years of business, 3 to 5 years? I'm seeing it from the outside now, not having I retired from retail in 2012. So I'm six years out and I'm looking back. What are you seeing being in the trenches?
I see a lot of the vendors are starting to separate in terms of the vendors that really do believe in the value of an independent bike shop as part of the sales process and those that don't. Right. You know, we've been distancing ourselves from vendors who, you know, who are going to sell online and undercut us. It's like, well, what are we doing here? You know, why am I competing with you? You know, aren't we supposed to be on the same team? You know, if I have a customer calling and saying, well, they're selling it on their website for 10% cheaper, do you match it? I'm like, well, no, because I already bought it. And now my inventory is going to be valued by my partner.
Right.
I think, I think what's going on too is there is, you know, there is a strong movement of vendors who feel we bike shop, you know, provide that level of credibility, that level of care, of selection for their products and want those products in our hands and not in, you know, consumer direct hands. People can't come in and say, hey, I saw this online for cheaper. Do you guys match it? I'm like, no, you didn't see it online because they don't sell it online. You know, you have a company like Chris King or Phil Wood who, you know, don't pursue that route. You know, you're not going to find it. And they've been able to keep the value of their products very high.
We're going to keep going because I want to talk about your 718 Express. What does 718 Cyclery stand for? How did you come up with that name?
Yeah, for most New Yorkers that grew up in a certain era here would know it instantly. For most other people, not so much. When the country went to area codes, basically Manhattan was 212,
right,
and everything else was 718.
So
in the 70s and 80s, kind of became synonymous with New York City, but not Manhattan, or the outer boroughs, or hip and cool. And I think of, you know, when I'm a kid, I think of like Saturday Night Fever. I think of all of these things that happen in the outer boroughs, which are, you know, the Bronx, Queens, Staten Island, and Brooklyn. There's four other chunks of the city besides Manhattan. So 718 kind of became, and you see it every once in a while, like kind of brought up, and there's some brands that kind of latch onto that, and T-shirts and things like that. So. And that's why the O logo looks like a phone, like a punch button phone. If you look at it, you know, it looks like the three buttons of a phone that you would push.
Aren't you clever?
Yeah, you know, I'm not a logo guy. I do a lot of graphics, and I just struck gold with that, and we just stuck with it.
It's very cool.
Yeah. Most people come in and think it's our address, or, you know, so many people are transplanted that live here, and also the idea of area codes meaning something geographically anymore really is, you know, doesn't happen so much because of cell phones. And ironically, we don't even have a 718 phone number, you know, in the shop.
I know. I didn't call that when I called you. But anyway,
yeah.
So let's talk about your 718 Express.
Yeah.
Let's talk about 718 Express. And we are going to talk about one of your adventure trips, because I think it's really cool that you put on that. You do things other bike shops, you know, depend on, come in and buy a bike. And you're not looking at that one category to be your overall income. So go ahead. What's 718 Express?
That's a kind of a new idea that we had in conjunction with a friend of mine who works at QBP. We just got to talking, and it's like, you know, I hate to think that we are kind of slaves to the people that are living around us that can make here and open the door, and that's a customer. I think there are tons of people that want to work with us that just might be remote, might not be close. So the idea was to hitch up a trailer. We built a sort of trailer up with a hitch on the front with you could put a bike on it, hooked it up to one of our Kona electric mountain bikes. And we're starting in Brooklyn. And that means that we can pick, you know, people make an appointment on their phone. You know, $20 for us to come get it. So the idea is to go and kind of, you know, cast a wider net. You know, let's see if there is a viable, like, customer base that's kind of beyond our reach here in Brooklyn. And, you know, the whole thing cost me like $25 to try out. You know, set up the website, I did a logo. You know, we have a joke here in the shop. I come up with lots of crazy ideas. But
which is a good thing.
Right. The idea is that it has to be something we can get out of quick and easy, right? If it's a dumb idea and it doesn't work, hey, I'm out $25. So the idea is that we, you know, we like to get in and out of things. It's, you know, we have a guy here who works in the stock market, and he always says, you know, you got to get off your losers, like get off as soon as you can. You know, it's not going to get better. It's going to get worse. So just recognize bad ideas. And then, you know, the idea is that much want more good ideas than bad ideas, and we'll be fine.
Best piece of advice I ever got from my dad, who was also a businessman: get out of your bad merchandise. I don't care what you get for it, and buy something that'll sell. Don't keep hoping somebody's going to give you that dollar or $2. Just get out of it. So he was always right. So that's really cool. How is 718 Express working?
So far, not so well. So far, we haven't had many bites. But, the weather here has been horrific. I mean, we've had three coastal storms, which are those nor'easter things. We've had one yesterday. So I think a lot of folks are, still hibernating in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool PR. It's something to write about. I can take pictures on Instagram. It's like, it's something that we can talk about that, it's almost like it doesn't even really exist, but we can talk about it until it actually does exist. And the other piece of advice I'll say real quick that I kind of follow is make every trade. You never know who you're talking to on the phone. You never know who's coming in the store. I do a lot of custom builds, stacking app stuff for people that fill out a form on a website. You just never know. So it's like make every trade.
It's a good piece of advice too. The last thing I want to talk about before we have to sign off and I ask you my three favorite questions is your bike trips. How do you work your bike trips, and what kinds of trips are they?
We have three different kinds of trips. The first are just, day rides that we do, in New York City. We call those bike club, and bike club meets every other Saturday morning. We open the shop at about 7. People roll in, they get coffee, my wife makes muffins. The day trip then rolls out from the shop about 40 miles, somewhere in New York City. There's lots of cool places to go. Those are our day trips. The next level up is what we call micro tour. The micro tour is leaving a Saturday, come back on a Sunday. And the idea there is to kind of get people thinking about bike touring and getting involved in it, and not missing work. And the stakes are pretty low. We're not going to be that far from civilization. So they're unsupported trips. We do once a month, starting in April. We get anywhere from 15 to 50 people on those trips. And we leave from the shop. We're pedaling out of the shop. 60 miles is like our kind of the radius of the group. And, there's a lot of stuff in, northern New Jersey and Westchester County. It gets pretty, it can get pretty rural pretty quick. And, we charge a nominal fee, for those. That's not a moneymaker. It's not a loss leader, but it's a way to kind of build a business around those activities. So, people come in looking for bikes. We have orientation classes. We have gear. We sell tons of bikepacking stuff. I mean, camping stoves. Like, I never dreamed I'd sell camping stoves.
Right.
Most of the shops right now in New York City are, I don't want to say jittery or scared, but everyone's kind of reverting to what they do, which is selling $500 hybrids. And that's what everyone, more or less kind of does. I think that, we've let other people take that route, and we've gone this route where we're selling, Revelate frame bags and hydration systems and water purification stuff. And it's all those kinds of things that, a lot of shops aren't going to carry. That's the micro tour, and that's overnight. In addition, we do three longer trips a year. We do one to the Berkshires in Hudson Valley. We do one to the Adirondacks, and in the fall, we do the Catskills. And it's about a week long, and we get 7 to 12 people on those. And it's led by two of their shop, guys who have done that ride before. And it's all unsupported. All the things I've described are unsupported. What always kind of comforts me is I realize and know that there's going to be an endless supply of people that live in the city that want to get out of the city on the weekends. That's never going to change. And that's kind of what we hang our hats on in terms of, the niche that we find ourselves in, this adventure kind of niche.
Well, geez, Joe, this has been a fascinating conversation. I really love your model, and I love the way you're willing to try something, and then if it doesn't work, to let it go and not have any, angst about it, which is a good thing.
Yep.
It's like, okay, this isn't working. Let's do something new. It's 718 Cyclery. So I'm going to ask you my questions, which, you'll see what it is. And then you're also going to let us know how my listeners can find out about your store, because I think it's really fascinating. So what is your favorite food?
Pizza.
Oh, gee, couldn't you be more original? But that's okay.
That's who I am.
That's true. Well, I already know that you love music. And so is there something besides Van Halen that is your favorite music?
In terms of a band or in terms of a genre?
Genre.
The shop calls it Joe Rock.
Joe Rock?
I call it Joe Rock, which is basically the music that I listen to. But it's defined a little better as, alternative stuff in the 80s and 90s would be a good way to describe it.
Okay.
R.E.M. There's nothing wrong with it.
No, there isn't. The last question is, do you have any pets?
Yeah, we have two shop cats that were feral and rescued about a year ago by an agency. And they've been with us for a year and 2 months. And, you know, the first 6 months we couldn't get near them. And they were hissing and scratching and spitting and hiding. But, yeah, they're kind of a big draw in the shop now. We have two cats. They're sisters.
Yeah, cats are fun. Cats are fun. And they will always surprise your customers. We had cats in the store at one point. And if somebody had been on a trip and their bike box was in the store, the one cat would crawl in the box and go to sleep every single time.
Oh,
it was hilarious. Anyway, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, yeah.
Tell our listeners how they can find out more about 718 Cyclery. What is your website?
Website's real simple. It's 718c.com.
And those are numbers, not you don't have to type in 718.
Yeah, right. The number 7, the number 1, the number 8, and the letter C is in Charlie. So we have apparently one of the last 4-digit websites when we got it. You can't get a 4-digit website anymore.
Well, it's very cool. And your logo is very cool. And thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. I hope you have a great selling season. Have a lot of fun because it sounds like you do.
You try.
All right. Take care.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.
Uh-huh. Bye.
Bye.
Joan Osella joined me from 718 Cycles in Brooklyn, New York. You can find out more about 718 Cycles at 718c.com. I'd like to thank Joe and Richard Schwinn for two very enjoyable conversations this week. We will be back next week with a brand new show, including a chat with author Colin O'Brien about his new book, The Beautiful Race, The Story of the Giro d'Italia. Pretty timely, huh? Coming up in May. So I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you for listening. Please remember to rate the show at your favorite podcast app website. Have a great week. Stay safe. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.